On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we react to Shohei Ohtani lowering his ERA to 0.74, one of the lowest marks ever through 10 starts. Then we react to the news that Aaron Judge is not going to play baseball for a while due to a stress fracture in his ribs. Why that is good, bad news for the New York Yankees. We react to Corbin Burns having a setback in his comeback from Tommy John surgery. The Padres keep on losing. And of course, it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, only baseball pod's best skill away from the ball field. Yeah. What is that? Cooking? I am skeptical that it is cooking.
Non-athletic.
Sure, there is something else. Yeah.
Non-athletic. Like, I want to know, what is he bad at physically? Like, we used to ask players this question all the time. The best answer ever we got was Dylan Carlson said he couldn't open a grocery bag at the grocery store. Like, he really struggled with that. But what is Ohtani bad at physically, and what is he really good at that isn't athletic? You know, can he knit? Is he a great driver? Maybe he's a great driver. We actually know he's not that great of a driver because there was that one time that he failed to parallel park. So
yes,
the mystery of Shohei Ohtani continues.
And yet, even if he does have literally no other skills, I think he's going to be just fine because baseball he is doing pretty well at. And once again, that is our opener.
.74. That is Shohei Ohtani's ERA this season through 61 innings. It is one of the lowest marks in the history of the sport through a player's first 10 starts. In fact, it is the third lowest. It's just nuts. Behind Jacob DeGrom's .56 in 2021 and Juan Marichal's .59 in 1966. Now, Ohtani's innings tick lower. DeGrom was at 64. Marichal, hilariously, was at 92. But the reason we're bringing this back up is because Shohei Ohtani attempting to win his first Cy Young has been one of the biggest stories in the sport for this season. And I think when we entered the season, Jordan, we were looking at it as like, this is possible. But it's more like, man, wouldn't this be cool? This would be a fun thing if this happened, if he got close and tried to win a Cy Young and locked in. And I think that as we previewed that, we were like, well, he's Shohei Ohtani. All he needs to do is focus on it and he'll do it. But which just sounds so simple and stupid. And yet here we are on June 5th, and it is undeniably in the realm of possibility.
And yeah, I think the premise of him trying to win the Cy Young was believable. And we'll have the innings conversation in a second. But the true talent that we've seen from him in the past on the mound was reflective of someone that could win the award. That said, once again, just as he did during his DH-only season, and he decided to do something that we had never seen before, or at least in the realm of something we had never seen before. I mean, 50-50, we certainly hadn't. But it is cool that he's now finding ways to end up on all-time leaderboards, even just as he is pitching. And that is why stopping here at this interval and marveling at these first 10 starts with the ERA numbers to support it is, I think, a worthwhile exercise. And to kind of dig into what has anything actually changed with Ohtani on the mound compared to his previous seasons? Because he's pitched a lot in the big leagues before now and has been very good. He has never been this good from a run prevention standpoint. So
in fact, it is worth talking about what has changed. Very few people have ever been this good from a run prevention standpoint through their first 10 starts, right? It is one thing to say, why is he better than his past self? But it is also interesting to look at why is he better than everyone else? So what is exactly different here?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that jumps out, and especially certainly when you compare him to some of the other pitchers that are at the top of this conversation of the National League Cy Young, certainly Jacob Mizrowski. Interestingly, Ohtani's just the pure peripheral strikeouts and walks are not outlandish by league standards or even by his own career standards. He's not suddenly striking out 50% of batters and has completely slashed his walk rate and his command. No, not really. The biggest difference is that just the quality of contact against him has gotten so much worse. He has a career high ground ball rate. It's up around 53%, which is top six in MLB. You know, home runs were never a huge issue for him, but still, just limiting the amount of airborne contact. The pulled fly ball rate against him is a career low. He's only allowed two home runs this season. That's a good way to prevent runs, as if the ball's never leaving the yard. He has had some issues with walks, relatively, not like a huge command issues, but there are guys on the bases here and there, but he's just not allowing the ball to go over the fence. He's only allowed two home runs this season in 10 starts. Those both came in the same start on May 5th against the Astros, Christian Walker and Braden Shoemake, the two guys to take Ohtani deep. But if you're trying to keep that ERA below one, not having the ball go over the fence is a good way to do that. And that is not just luck. It is a fact that, as I just mentioned, he's keeping the ball on the ground more than ever.
I also do think, I want to be very clear, I'm not trying to rain on Mr. Ohtani's parade nor downplay the brilliance of what he has done and is continuing to do. If you look at the game log and you take a glance at some of the offenses that he's seen, it is not exactly baseball's murderer's row, right? And I wonder if that is maybe some of the reason that the contact quality is maybe lower than you'd expect, right? We have 10 starts, Guardians, Jays, the awful Mets at their absolute bottom, Giants, Marlins, Astros, who are good. They can hit. That's the two home runs. Giants, Padres, Rockies, Diamondbacks. So this is, I don't think, I would have to dig into this a little bit more, but it's not as if he's faced a handful of top flight offenses at their absolute peak. That does not mean he's not having a great season. I just think it might be part of why some of the expected stats are a little bit worse than what you would expect. I know that's a kind of a dumb way to phrase that, but I do think that that is an important factor when you're dealing with a 10 start sample.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally fair. But man, I mean, it's not just the ERA, the total, we talk about contact quality, but just all around production, 435 OPS against.
Incredible.
Which is barely better than Miz. Like Miz is, I think, like 438 or something. So that's very, very, very close. But that is the second lowest ever for a starter behind only DeGrom. And that's the thing. When you watch him, he does generally seem in control. He's gone six innings in almost every start. I think there was
every
one with seven.
One
with seven. Maybe one that was a little bit shorter.
I have it in front of me. There were two with seven and one with five. But two besides that, he has gone exactly six innings in every single start.
Yes. Now, that said, we'll circle back to the innings conversation. But I want to mention that because it's not like he's not going deep into games. He's doing his part there. He's just only starting once a week. He's starting less frequently than other starters, and that's part of why he's not going to be able to get to the innings total that, you know, Christopher Sanchez is 25 innings ahead of him or so, you know, roughly. The other thing I also want to hit on, first of all, I want to quickly mention related to his start on Wednesday, because we talk about the innings total. He went six innings on Wednesday against Arizona, six scoreless, two hits, one walk, six strikeouts, only 89 pitches, and they were up 5-0. That seemed like a situation where he would maybe go out there and throw another inning or two. However, it sounds like he's dealing with a blister. Now, Dave Roberts downplayed how significant this is, but they showed him kind of playing with it on the bench. And I wonder in that situation, that was where they were trying to be kind of preventative and not push it in a game where they were already comfortably ahead. And while they're saying it's not a big deal, as we know, anything with Ohtani is a big deal. So while I am not going to super overreact to this being a thing, this is my first recollection of him dealing with something like a blister and at least something to monitor as we move forward with his starts. That said, what we saw on Wednesday was also notable in that the last part about what's different or what's the same is just the pitch mix. This is something I know that you both of us like to dig into when we're trying to figure out how pitches ever have improved or regressed, how pitchers are attacking certain handedness. And honestly, Ohtani, we've thought throughout his career, and this is true for a lot of the Japanese pitchers, at least until Imai and Roki Sasaki, who are, you know, doing their best with two pitches. But, you know, the Yu Darvish and certainly Yamamoto.
It's a deep mix.
Tanaka, it's a deep mix. And Ohtani, throughout his career, it has also been a deep mix. And he's shown five, six, seven pitches this season, but really he's just kind of doing it with fastball sweeper. And on Wednesday in particular, I think it was like 80%, almost 90% just fastball, four-seam fastball sweeper, 11% curveball, 3% splitter. We've seen a little bit more splitters this year compared to last year. That did seem to be a pitch he was kind of easing off from as he was coming back from Tommy John. But it's not like he's going up there and like some of the, like a lot of modern pitchers now, like Paul Skenes is a great example of this, right? Who are going 10% with five or six different pitches. He's really just ripping fastballs and sweepers. And from a run value standpoint, they've been two of the best pitches in the league. So he's getting the results that he needs with them. And to me, I almost wonder if he's just rolling with this simplified mix as long as he can. And as he faces teams for another time later in the season, or he faces better opponents, that's when he starts breaking out the sinker. That's when he starts breaking out the splitter more if we get to the postseason. Because right now, there's no need to overcomplicate it. I mean, these two pitches are so good. His velocity has been so good that he can get by like this.
I mean, I'm interested in how things are playing against lefties, because historically, as a right-handed pitcher, Ohtani has been worse against left-handed batters than he has against right-handed batters. That has not been the case this year. He's been equally dominant against both sides of the plate. He is throwing more heaters, and he is throwing, compellingly for me, more sweepers, because that is not a pitch you often see deployed against opposite-handed pitching, opposite-handed hitters. You'll see like the back foot slider or a back foot sweeper from a lefty arm against like a right-handed batter. What Ohtani is doing, and he did this a couple times a couple nights ago against the Diamondbacks, to Corbin Carroll on the outer half, where he just like flips that sweeper in and backdoors it to try and steal a strike early in a count. And like the pitch just has so much freaking movement that our conceptions and like the laws of pitching apply less. It's like, oh, well, you shouldn't throw your sweeper to opposite-handed hitters. It's like, well, if your sweeper looks like Shohei Ohtani's sweeper, like you're probably going to be okay. And so him leaning on those best pitches more often, I think that is an interesting development, and is something that when I am around the Dodgers, when I return to America, hopefully I will ask and get to the bottom of a little bit. Where I'm at right now, dude, with Ohtani, the pitcher, I feel gratitude, because I think that, you know, we toe the line of talking about this guy all the time and being amazed by what he is and feeling this obligation to talk about him because he is so singular, and we are living in this time where we get to cover this one-of-a-kind character. And then there's like a level of exhaustion where, especially last year, I spent so much time thinking and writing about Ohtani's return to the mound, right? I was at Citi Field the day he threw that first pen, and I was just really dug into that narrative. And it paid off to a pretty real extent. I mean, this guy started Game 7 of the World Series, right? Duh. But I was like kind of worried that maybe he would come back in 2026 and he would be just okay and he would not be an impact arm. And it'd be like, oh, well, we spent all that energy for this guy to come back and be mid. Not what happened. And it makes a lot of that time that all of us poured into tracking his return feel more worth it in a way. And again, maybe we never should have doubted to begin with, because this is the guy that we've always been dealing with. But this is why, I guess, we spent so much time talking about his comeback when we did.
Yeah, 100%. And it's so cool. It's the coolest thing ever. He's the best player of all time. And it's not, we don't have to hesitate when we say it. It's so funny. And by the way, since May 12th, he's hitting .438, .533, .753, 1.7 F4, which is far and away the most in baseball over that span. Hmm. And that's just as a hitter. You can tack on another 0.8 F4 as a pitcher or during that span when he's allowed like one run. And so that's when I see headlines on MLB.com. I know Will Smith had the quote being like, he's the best player that's ever walked this earth. And then you have an MLB.com headline saying, seven reasons Ohtani might really be the best player that's ever walked this earth. I don't even know if we need to get to seven. I mean, I'll read that because I'm sure it's interesting, but it's like,
I don't think that's that complicated. Yeah, it's just the thing. He's just him. Is he the most accomplished player to have ever walked the earth? No, obviously not. Does he have the best statistical resume? Not yet. No. But like, if you're talking about peak, it's just not even a conversation anymore at this point. No one has done this. No one else has done anything. It's not that no one else has done this. We've talked about, I mean, we're beating a dead horse here. Like three guys have done like the Michael Lorenzen thing, you know, where you like played a little bit of outfield once. Like if he was okay at both, it would still be incredible, right? Yep. There is a decent chance that he wins. Like he could win the Cy Young this year. I don't think he will still. I think there is a chance he does. If he wins a Cy Young, put that in a bucket A, and then he has this MVP where he didn't pitch.
Right.
Like right. In a different season. Like that cannot be topped. That cannot be topped.
Yeah. So let's just finish on that. We will continue to update this. But we're just gearing up here for an all-time race. And
Ohtani's biggest competitor here, It is not the hitters he is facing. Right. The biggest obstacle to his chances are the likelihood that we have a potentially generational race shaping up, like you mentioned.
Yes.
There have been years in the past where if Ohtani finished with 158 innings and a 1-2-2, I would be like, he's going to win that Cy Young. That does, we are not moving in that direction as Christopher Sanchez, what a bum, finally gave up a run, finishing his scoreless streak at 50 and a third consecutive scoreless innings. He could finish, Christopher Sanchez could finish with like 225 innings, which is a thing that has not happened in a long time. Like he could get up there. I mean, he is working deep into games at this point, and the Phillies are going to probably need every last start from him. So I think Sanchez at this current moment is his biggest competitor for the Cy Young.
Yeah, I agree. And Sanchez is at 80. I mean, he's made three more starts than Ohtani already.
Yeah.
He's at the 13 starts. He's at 86 in the third innings. And so, but listen, it was not that long ago, 2021, Corbin Burnes won the Cy Young barely. I mean, that's one of the closest votes we've ever had. They both had the same number of first place votes. He barely won over Zach Wheeler. Corbin Burnes had 167 innings. Zach Wheeler had 213. So that's probably what we're going to be looking at. And in that case, it was much closer. I don't know exactly what the discrepancy is going to have to be. I mean, Sanchez's ERA is now below 1.5 also. It's not 0.74. Yeah. There's a gap there that is going to be enough
for Ohtani to win. I also think that it's all about, yes, that is very true. Those are the two gaps that Ohtani will need to bridge. And I think Mizorowski is a separate conversation here where he'll probably fall in the middle, right? Yeah, but he's in between those two.
Yeah, exactly.
Where it's like, if Ohtani is a half run better than Sanchez and Sanchez has 50 more innings, I think Sanchez wins, right? But I think if Ohtani is a run better and has 40 fewer innings, right? It's like there's a scale here and we have to pull the levers to see how it all is going to pan out. Just quickly on Sanchez, he is averaging 6 2/3 a start right now, I believe. Okay, which just is amazing in this era of baseball to average 6 2/3. And I think he has just an absolute stinker mixed in there where he only
weren't short. He allowed a bunch of runs. He might have had a short stinker.
Yeah. If you multiply that by 34 starts, 6.6, that's 224 2/3 innings, right? Like totally could get to that number. Do I think he will? No, because I'll always round down on anybody's innings projection because this is 2026 here. Let's pivot to Miz, though.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Miz represents the middle ground between these two guys where, like, he has been the most dominant, overwhelmingly dominant in the traditional swing and miss strikeout sense of the word. And for that reason, you could do you feel like a little bit better projecting that forward as the season goes on?
I think, yes, hitters are batting 149 against Jacob Mizorowski, which is decent. Now, they're batting 142 against Shohei Ohtani, so that's also pretty decent. I mean, to me, it's just I need to see Jacob Mizorowski throw 150 innings, right? I mean, like, we talk about Ohtani's workload. We did see him throw that many a few years ago. Yeah. Jacob Mizorowski has, I mean, let's see, he threw 97 in the minor leagues in 2024. Last year, I guess he got to 120, 130, if you include the postseason between the majors and the minors. But he's also, he's like left multiple outings with little hamstring issues and
cramps.
Let's hope that the arm stays okay. But
that's the thing. If he starts eating bananas and like drinking pickle juice, it's over.
Sanchez Ohtani, no chance.
Yeah. No chance.
So, and by the way, also, we obviously are leading this whole segment talking about ERA. There's going to be other numbers that are going to impact. That's why I mentioned the OPS allowed. That's why I mentioned the FIP and the strikeout rate and all those things. And a lot of those peripherals helped Burns in particular, we should mention, right? Not that Zach Wheeler was bad in those categories, but the ERA wasn't that much lower than Zach Wheeler. We know that modern voters are going to consider a lot of other things. So there's going to be other ways that Sanchez looks like the clear answer, that Ohtani looks like the clear answer, that Mizorowski looks like the clear answer. And let's be fair, Jake Mintz, because we still have a lot of baseball left to play. Paul Skeens is still in this league. Yoshinobu Yamamoto is still in this league. Zach Wheeler is pitching real well. Like, there are a lot of other great pitchers in this league that we assumed are still going to be a part of this. Skeens for sure is not someone we should be totally moving to the side. So, but this three alone is just so compelling. And truly now on a week-to-week basis, normally you're not thinking about this kind of race until August, where you're tracking every start and wondering like, oh, who just jumped ahead? Who fell behind? I'm already there between these three because they've been that good.
It helps that Ohtani is like always pitching on Wednesday.
Yeah, you can really plan like around that. Yeah.
Like, because the Dodgers are running the six man, so you're like, oh, it's Wednesday, right? Miz and Sanchez is a little bit different. The one thing about Miz, okay, so let me just ask the dumb clippable question. Who do you think wins? I think, man. Let me make the Miz argument. Can I make the Miz argument?
Please.
If you look at his innings per game so far this season, right? He's adding more as he's gone. Over the first month, it was between 5 and 6. And in the second month in May, it was between 6 and 7. And even as he's moved into 6-7, the pitches are not going above 100. Like, his pitch counts compared to the innings are unreal. Like, 6 innings, 95, mm-hmm. 7 innings, 93, 6 innings, 74, 7 innings, 96, 7 innings, 88. And that's because the Brewers are being, even with his dominance, they're still monitoring the workload a little bit. And I imagine they will continue to do so as well. But you can imagine just like, okay, for all of these starts, you just run Miz back out there for one more inning. Like, he has the bullets in the tank there. Yeah. And I would be really interested to see if the team feels more comfortable to continue to, like, there's more room to push. Whereas, like, for Christopher Sanchez, the Phillies aren't going to, like, lean on him more than they already have, I think. And Ohtani is similar in that way. They're letting Ohtani work deep into games, for sure. There might be a little bit more room there, but I don't envision a world in which the Dodgers are going to move to a five-man rotation from a six-man in order to get Ohtani a better shot at the Cy Young, right? And so the circumstances at play here don't necessarily benefit him.
I agree. I think right now I'd still say Sanchez. My worry with him is that now he has upped the strikeouts recently, so, you know, it is what it is. However,
is your worry with him Alec Bohm?
Well, so I was going to say, some of the fluky nonsense with him early in the season when he was allowing a bunch of hits, if that resurfaces again, the margins here, when we are talking about the ERA, is going to be so slim that one clunker in late August could be the difference. Not that Otani's incapable of serving up a couple home runs to a better lineup, and if those are three-run home runs, then the whole thing, the conversation becomes different. But yeah, and again, like, there's Chris Sale, Chase Burns, I mean, Kyle Harrison's ERA is lower than Jacob Mizorowski's. I mean, all of these guys, so at least one of these other guys is going to push their way into the conversation. I do believe that, with the other ones probably coming back to earth a little bit. That's why I think we have to savor this current moment where we are looking at three pitchers off to three pitchers, arguably Kyle Harrison also, at least three pitchers off to historic starts in the National League. And that's awesome. And then they're not Paul Skeens.
And I think they all offer something different, which I really like.
Yeah.
Where Sanchez is who I want to win, like rooting for a guy, right? Because the dude that's going to get to 220 in this era of baseball, like, I would have voted for Wheeler and the Wheeler Burns. Like, you know me, I love innings. I think innings are the most underrated stat for pitchers. I think that when your bullpen is like Phillies is, where it's not that good, right? Like, they need every single starting pitcher inning. That is how the Phillies have existed. And Sanchez is kind of feeds into that. Miz is a great one for people because it's like, he's not walking guys. Like, the worry with Miz is that he had all these limbs and that he didn't wasn't going to know where to put him, and then he was just going to walk too many dudes to work deep into games. He walked six guys across six starts in May.
Yeah.
Like, he is already doing this, which is just amazing. And then obviously the argument, you know, to root for Otani is, well, he hits. He also hits.
Well, right. Is that going to help him? Like, I think it makes it more fun to vote for, but I'm not sure. It's interesting.
Do you think that we will see an argument from a voter that says, well, Otani's also hitting, so he gets a little bit more slack when you line these two up?
Probably. Which is like, I don't know. I'm not that opposed to that line of thinking, even
which
though
is like fair,
I think
right?
The most
because
fair...
it is it more is what Otani is doing is more impressive, even if the stats are the same. Like, if Mizorowski and Otani finish with identical stats at the end of the year in every single category, you have to vote for Otani because he's also hitting.
Right. Well, sure. I mean, the problem is Otani breaks a lot of these conversations. I guess the last thing I'll say about this, and then we'll take a break. Christopher Sanchez, famously, unanimous second place last year.
Mm.
Paul Skeens got all 30 first place votes. Christopher Sanchez got all 30 second place votes. If I will make one prediction about this, it is that that will not happen to him again.
Like, there will be no unanimity.
There is no way that he is finishing unanimous in any spot, but I certainly don't think it's going to be unanimous second. And if I'm wrong about that, please clip this in November, and I am excited to marvel at whoever beat him to that degree and, I guess, finish, like, whatever. Whatever weird circumstance led us to him finishing second with all 30 second place once again, that would be amazing.
Last question. Are these the finalists? Mizorowski, Sanchez, Otani, are they the three Cy Young finalists at the end of the year?
Oh, man. I hope so, because that means they've all stayed healthy and they've all continued to cook at this level. But, like, there's just too many other good pitchers. It's a long way to go, man. We got 100 more games. So I'll probably say the odds are no, but it would be cool if they can somehow hold it up. Hold up all the way to the end. All right, before we take a break, want to let everybody know that the all-new 2026 Soccer Pick'em is here just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament. Make your picks each round, earn points, climb the leaderboard, play solo, create a private group with your friends, join a public group to play with other fans, or even join our Yahoo Sports group to see if you can beat us. Join at yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em, yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em.
I've in Europe right now studying, grinding tape, you know, where people here are pretty jazzed up for the footy. Although I was in Italy where people were not jazzed up for the not footy. Here in Sweden, where I currently am, there are so many like posters and, you know, promos for the upcoming tournament. I am very excited. Jordan, maybe you and I could sell some organs and go to a game together. Buy some tickets. We will be right back on Baseball Barbacast talking about a man who also needs a little bit of medical help. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let us go around the hospitals, the league. Aaron Judge has a boo-boo, a big bad boo-boo, a boo-boo that a boo-boo fitting of the size of the man is, I guess, maybe another way to put it. Stress fracture in his rib on his right side. Is Aaron Judge hurt? How hurt is Aaron Judge? Commentary, narrative, discourse has been quite a story over the last couple of days, figuring out what was wrong with the game's best hitter. There were second opinions, I believe. He flew to Dallas to see a doctor that was a thoracic outlet specialist, which was very concerning because that would have been much, much worse than this outcome, which is not ideal. But the Yankees have said that Aaron Judge is expected to be back before the end of the season. He will do nothing but hang out with his, I believe, one-year-old daughter for the next 4 to 6 weeks before getting more imaging and seeing where to go from there. I think the Yankees, this is good, bad news.
Yes, it is, because of what you referred to. They're describing the timeline, which is, thoracic outlet is a terrifying thing, normally more associated with pitchers. I mean, listen, Judge has been pretty injured throughout his career. He's been very healthy the last 2 years, thankfully, aside for a brief, oh my God, he can't throw. Last year, he missed 10 games due to that right flexor strain.
So wild, because it wasn't like, oh, Aaron Judge can kind of throw. Like, he didn't go from throwing 98 or 95 in the outfield to throwing like 85. It was like 60-0, you know? This year is just totally bats his back.
And yet it's like, the range, and I've been thinking about this now because it seems like Connor Griffin is dealing with the same thing. The range of just how concerning position player throwing arm injuries has been very difficult to like wrap my mind around. So
yeah,
we've had Soto had like a brief scare, obviously Judge. So anyway, but the point is that Judge the last 2 years has been healthy. He's MVP, obviously best hitter we've ever seen. The last time we saw Judge miss an extended period of time was 2023, when he crashed into the Dodger Stadium outfield fence and sprained his right big toe. And that was notable. First of all, weird, happened almost exactly the same time. I believe June 3rd was when that happened last year. Now, this injury has been a little bit more slow forming. Sounds like he's been dealing with this for the last few weeks, and you can kind of tell his numbers have really tailed off. But Yankees fans, when they get this news and they remember, oh my God, wait, this seems familiar. 2023 was not a good year in the Bronx.
No.
They essentially... I mean, they weren't even that good before he got hurt that year. They were below 500 while he was out. He returned from that toe injury at the very, very, very end of July. Played the rest of the way. They weren't good. They won 82 games. It's the worst season since 1995. So when you think, oh my God, Judge is going to be out for a long time, the team's going to collapse, this is a very different situation. This team is so much better than that team for so many other reasons. We'll talk about how they're going to actually replace him in the outfield, which is an interesting conversation. And obviously the lineup is much worse without Aaron Judge in it. But there's a lot of other reasons why I don't think Yankees fans need to panic. And part of just not just the diagnosis that they expect to have him back at some point this season. Although if that could be August 1st, that could be September 1st. That could be this is so vague that it's really hard to say how much Judge they're going to get for the rest of this regular season. But that combined with the state of the American League means this is not, freak out time, I think, for New York. But it's still a big deal for reasons beyond the Yankees, which I will get into. But keeping the focus on the Yankees, where they go from here, what are your other takeaways?
the rotation has always been the backbone, right? Where with the pitching that is this good, the Yankees will be able to survive missing Aaron Judge. They have the second best starter ERA in the sport behind only the Dodgers, and that is with Max Fried having been out. It feels like this is a great comparison to the Red Sox, okay? The Red Sox, who we will laugh at later, have been missing their best hitter and their best pitcher for a long stretch of the season. And it has effectively left them in what may be an insurmountable lurch, right? The Yankees lost Max Fried a couple of weeks ago now and are now losing Aaron Judge. And it doesn't meaningfully change the way that I feel about them as a team, which is a credit to Brian Cashman and the way that he has built this roster and the depth of the lineup and the strength of the rotation. Now, that's probably underselling it. You lose Aaron Judge, it's a big deal. Ben Rice turning into a god very much helps things, but it is a easy way to compare these two teams, right? Where it's like, I expect the Yankees to weather this, right? You would agree? Like, are you freaking out here?
No, but it's timely you mentioned that, as the Red Sox will be playing the Yankees this weekend in New York. So you will see that contrast of depth of roster quality there. As for how they're going to replace him specifically, some reports that Spencer Jones is getting called back up. Now, that's interesting because, you know, during this week against Cleveland, when Judge was out, they used Jose Caballero and Max Schumann, their utility men, to kind of cover in right field. Spencer Jones is kind of a one-for-one, all right, tall outfielder, go out there in right field. If you're wondering about Jason Dominguez, he's working his way back from his own injury, shoulder injury. I think he's going on a rehab assignment this weekend. I am curious about Dominguez and where he fits in here because, first of all, he's essentially never played right field in pro ball. So if he does come up and they do want it to be Dominguez instead of Jones, which would make sense because Dominguez is just more experienced and has proven more offensively in the big leagues, I would expect Bellinger to then flip over to right and keep Dominguez in left field.
Which will hurt
Dominguez
them.
In left field, which will hurt them for sure, because left field has seemingly proven to be more important defensively in Yankee Stadium than right. But Dominguez has only played left. He's played center. He's not a good defender. So more importantly, what are we getting from Dominguez as a hitter? That is a big question. Is Spencer Jones going to actually get some runway here? That would be interesting. He really didn't get much when he was up before, unsurprisingly. But offensively, they're still in decent shape. Stanton is not really close to coming back, but presumably we'll see him at some point this summer. Goldschmidt has been great. But listen, Aaron Judge right now, and yes, the last few weeks have been bad and that's hurt it. He's third on the team in WAR behind Rice and Cody Bellinger. So they have these two other guys that have been terrific.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, like this should still be an above average lineup, at least at the top, especially if they can get Jazz going. Because the bottom of it right now is still not awesome, but that's a lot of teams.
Volpe's been okay, it seems. You know, I've been gallivanting around the world. He hasn't been a total nothing burger, I guess.
We're not talking about him, which is probably a good thing, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a good way to think about it.
The dynamic now for the Yankees is very simple, right? They are going to be in the playoffs. I would be floored if they do not enter October. That is why the Judge injury is not as concerning as it might be in a year where there are two other horrifying teams in the division. I think at this point in time, the Rays are scary and the Orioles are playing better, but I don't think like Yankee fans are afraid of them right now. Maybe the Rays, but I don't think they're like afraid of Toronto or Baltimore or Boston right now. Things could change. The Jays at this point last year were not exactly playing the best baseball in the world, right? And so it's early. It's still relatively early. So the season all just comes down to, can they win the division and guarantee themselves the bye? Because
whoever wins the AL East is probably going to get that. And whoever finishes second, even though that team, whether it's Tampa or New York, probably will end up with the second best record in the AL. If you don't win the division, you just get bumped down to the wild card round as the four seed. And so I think that is kind of the main storyline for the rest of the Yankee season. Based upon what we've been told about Judge, if he is at his Judge self for the first game of October, that is all that matters. And so the rest of the season for him is just getting right for whenever that day comes.
Yeah. Two other things I'll say on this, and then we'll hit another injury update. One is the Rays have lost 8 of their last 10, just got swept at home by the Tigers. They're starting to kind of look a little bit more normal.
This was going to happen.
That's fine. And then another thing, which I've mentioned a few times in the last few weeks, but now we can say it for sure. This was true even before Judge got hurt because he was only playing at a very high level instead of well better than everybody else. We're going to have an AL MVP that is not named Aaron Judge or Shohei Ohtani. And you know the last time that happened?
Mookie Betts?
No, not quite. 2020.
Jose Abreu
in 2020, Trout in 19, but and then I guess Mookie, right, in 18.
In 2018, yeah. Bad guess.
But yeah, Ohtani 21, Judge 22, Ohtani 23, Judge 24, Judge 25, but he ain't winning it this year. And so who it's going to be, that's a much longer conversation. We'll do it another time. But that is a significant historic moment because guess what? Ohtani's going to win again. He's defending it. But Judge is not going to, he's not going to three-peat. So that is notable.
Dude, I just went to Fangraphs and did war for the AL. I think if it's not Bobby Witt Jr., like I know the offensive numbers are a bit down and he's been better recently. If Bobby Witt doesn't win it this year, I think he'll be kicking himself. I think this is the year he's got to go get it. I know the Royals have been like a total disaster show. But it does kind of feel like it'll be Bobby against Jordan.
And I will say, I have said many times, Bobby Witt is Gen Z Trout. What a better tribute than to win MVP on a team that wins 74 games.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... That's as Trout as it gets, baby. So very, very, very possible. All right. A couple other things before we take a break and do the good, the bad, the ugly. Another interesting injury update, and that's Corbin Burnes, who's working his way back from Tommy John surgery, but suffered a teres major strain, which is like a lat shoulder.
Isn't that a constellation?
Yeah, I think so. This is not good. I'll be honest, haven't thought about Corbin Burnes very much this season. However, the Diamondbacks are not a bad baseball team, and this would be a nice guy to get back. Their pitching has been way better over the last month, like improved a ton after a disastrous April. So credit to those
there
guys.
There was a story I saw. I can't remember who wrote it. Probably was Steve Gilbert at MLB.com about how in Chicago at the series I happened to be at, Torey Lovello pulled all the Diamondback starters into a room and just was like, you guys need to be better at this.
Figure it out.
He was basically just like, figure it out. Like, this is bad. Yeah. Like, don't pitch like this. And so then they were like, okay. It's so funny how it works sometimes. Like, you just need your boss to tell you to like be better at your job. And you're like, oh yeah, I can do that for a month. Sure. Yeah. I'll give you a month. I can lock in for a month. And they've locked in for a month.
They have. That said, it would be nice if they could get Corbin Burnes back. And it sounds like that's not happening anytime soon. So, it just sucks. I mean, for this guy he was like a main character in baseball, right? He had been a main character, and obviously anybody that gets injured like this is going to be off the radar a little bit, but the degree to which he's just kind of fallen out, and being on the Diamondbacks, frankly, is going to contribute to that. But, now it's an even more interesting question is just where are they in the standings when he comes back? Because, he is still a pitcher that people should care about.
One final injury. Nate Castellanos' pride appears to be broken. I don't know if that one's repairable. The Phillies and... that's too mean. I'm joking. Nate Castellanos, who could have seen this coming? Only all of us was DFA'd by the San Diego Padres after a truly horrendous run to start the year in San Diego. He had 1 year left on his contract with the Phillies. Things fizzled out there. He was straight up released after the Phillies could not find a trade partner for him, and was just an awful hitter for the Padres. Now, the worst part is that this happened to him while the team was in Philadelphia. So he had to go and do the scrum with all the Phillies reporters and be like, things didn't work out here. They didn't want me in the clubhouse. No, Nick, they didn't want you on the field because your hitting was bad and your fielding was worse. And then he got DFA'd. This really should have just been my bad now that I'm thinking about it. You know, you could also frame it as an injury, I guess.
Yeah. And this is just Nick Castellanos is not hitting, and so he got DFA'd. Now, I'm not saying the Padres should DFA their whole team, because then you wouldn't be able to continue to compete in the 2026 Major League Baseball season. However, he's not the only one not hitting. And the Padres were swept in Philadelphia. They have the worst OPS in baseball at 651. They're hitting .216 as a team, which is so bad. Their run differential is now in the negatives. They're 6.5 games behind the Dodgers. And now behind the Diamondbacks, who we just mentioned, who are, you know, just walked off the Dodgers last night. So just a really bad stretch for San Diego. And there were signs when their record was really good that this is maybe not going to last. But as we start heading towards the deadline, we know the Padres are going to be someone we're talking about. But they're going to have to play a little bit better to now I don't think it's going to stop Preller from trying to do something crazy regardless, but this is just a bad looking ball club right now. And even though they're pitching, the bullpen remains awesome. This is not good enough right now.
They're just embarrassed, and you know what it is? They're nervous in front of the new owner.
Oh, interesting.
playing tight.
Well, you better figure that out, because this is a yikes first impression, I would say.
My man might have bought a lemon.
Well, there's a lot going on in San Diego, but I imagine we will continue to talk about them. They are always interesting. But right now,
no God, free ads, but
goodness, you should. This offense.
No free ads. You should check the Carfax.
On that note, we're going to take a break. When we return, the Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
Welcome back to Baseball Bar the Cast. It is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. After you.
Oh, I get to go first? What a gentleman. Something good, something bad, something ugly from the week that was. I will begin with something that is ongoing, and that is just sorry to hit you with some FOMO. As I'm sure you've had a wonderful vacation, but my goodness, Jake Mintz, have you missed an unbelievable week of college baseball and softball? We had the D3 baseball championship wrapping up. Congratulations. Oh, God, it hurts me to say it, but congratulations to Denison walking it off to win their first ever D3 championship. We had Texas well-deserved softball. Well-deserved. Well-deserved.
Quickly,
congrats to Coach Deegan. Yes.
A program that deserved to win a championship.
100%.
Simple as. Denison, the biggest rival of Jordan's alma mater, Worcester Fighting Scots, who were not doing a whole lot of fighting this season, unfortunately.
No, but Denison, that's a hell of a program, and they definitely deserved it. Texas softball winning their second consecutive national championship. Tegan Kavan building on her legendary career. Texas Tech kind of crashing out in disappointing fashion. Again, we'll encourage everyone to go read Cassandra Negley's stories all about the action in Oklahoma City. And then what I think you have been keeping up with a little bit more so, which is just the complete chaos of the Division I baseball tournament. We have Super Regionals beginning this weekend. Just an absurd weekend of regional play last weekend. All kinds of unexpected nonsense happening. The top two seeds, UCLA and Georgia Tech, losing in stunning fashion in kind of different ways, but both just kind of really
sad,
breathtaking. I mean, the way the Georgia Tech lost, getting walked off on their own field by Oklahoma, and now setting up this amazing super regional weekend where you have Kansas hosting still. You have West Virginia hosting still. You have a super regional between Little Rock and Troy. Like those two teams, one of those two teams winner is going to go Omaha. Oh my God. So this is going to be such a fun weekend of college baseball.
The outrageousness of the college baseball regionals, which I did follow from afar, even though squeeze play is not available in Italy, get it together, figure it out. It made me really love our sport. And I don't necessarily mean the big leagues or even college baseball. It made me love the game of baseball because it is way more, for lack of a better term, NIL proof than any other sport at the college level. I think college softball is too dependent on one dominant pitcher. Smaller number of players, where if you have like one of the top 10 pitchers in the sport, good chance you're going to Oklahoma City, right?
Yep.
Because they can pitch most of the games. Basketball and football, we have seen in the NIL era that the top has gotten just more top heavy, and we haven't had as many mid-major programs at the top of the sport challenging for national championships. And I think that because baseball is just more inherently random, it lends itself so much better to Cinderellas. And I am very grateful for that. Now, that is different than the transfer portal. And I think we talked about this at the beginning of the season. Like Kansas, that team is built on the transfer portal. But when I talk about NIL, what I'm really meaning is that the big, bad, rich programs scooping up all the best players, you know, and hoarding them for themselves. Well, like LSU didn't even make the tournament this year. And I am encouraged by that dynamic that our sport is, you know, seems to be at least a little bit more resistant to those forces than some of the other ones at the college level.
Yeah, I agree with that. And yet we might still have five SEC teams in Omaha. Georgia is entirely built on plucking the best players from mid-majors, and they got a good chance to win. So it's a good balance. It's a good balance. And yeah, I mean, the Super Regional weekend is so much fun. So looking forward to digging into that, which starting in about 2 hours, they'll be playing in Morgantown.
Let me see. Maybe it's available here in Sweden. Who can say? My good this week, friend of the program, Sarah Langs. It was Lou Gehrig Day earlier this week, and so I wrote about Sarah over at Yahoo Sports. Thank you to everybody who read that, and mostly thank you to Sarah, who did not need to talk to me or answer my questions, and yet she did, because she is a kind soul who took pity on a doofy sports writer. She is a singular individual. If you're listening to this podcast, I would encourage you to go read what I wrote. But Lou Gehrig Day, which is MLB's annual notch on the calendar to kind of spotlight ALS, Lou Gehrig disease, and the efforts being made to find a cure for ALS and to help people living with ALS. The story I really wanted to get across is that Sarah has ALS, but she's not defined by it. And I got to effectively hang out with her for a day and watch her work. And I didn't really write about that experience because it was a little too personal, but I'll just sort of try and explain here that just seeing this human being do what she does was one of the most impressive, remarkable things. If you've ever been at a game, if you work in the industry, you see Sarah at games with her screens up while watching the game in front of her. There is no one like her. I am humbled that she allowed me to write about her. I am humbled to be her friend, and I am humbled to share a baseball space at the same time as her. She is legitimately an inspiration. What an individual.
Yeah. And obviously she has, while you detailed very beautifully in your story, is not defined by it. She of course still has found a lot of incredible connections to ALS in the current MLB community, including, we should just mention, I don't know if you saw the story last night, but Chad Dallas making his major league debut with the Toronto Blue Jays and found out that he was getting called up on Lou Gehrig Day, and his father passed away from ALS last year. So that was another close connection. I know there's a couple others scattered throughout the sports, but yeah, I mean, Sarah's unbelievable, and she's just the best.
She says she's unbelievable. The best,
but She's the best. She's at the same time, Sarah Langs.
At the same time, like, we do need more people to keep her honest, that her ego doesn't go to her head. You know, people are always saying Sarah's the best. Sarah's the best. Like, if someone out there could, you know, I'll say it here. You can clip this. Sarah Langs is the worst. Sarah Langs.
Overrated. Thumbnail. Make sure we do the thumbnail.
Overrated.
For YouTube. Langs overrated. No.
Overrated.
Sarah, we love you. Let's go to bad. Boston Red Sox.
Boston
Red Sox lost a series this week at home against the Orioles of Baltimore. They are now 1-8-1 in home series this season, 10-21 at Fenway Park. Oh my goodness. That would be the worst winning percentage at Fenway Park ever by a Red Sox ball club.
Which is impressive. Remember, this team, for much of its history, was terrible.
That's one good point. And then the other good point.
Always played there.
That's true. But yet, we're not talking about truest park history. We're not talking about Marlin Lone Depot. This stadium has been open since 1912. And this is the worst they've ever. Listen, small sample, okay? They got a long way to go. They could turn it around, right? I don't know, man. This is just bleak. Brian Baio got crushed again. He just got optioned to AAA, which is really embarrassing for him, for the organization who invested heavily in him via extension. That's super disappointing. Yikes. Especially as, like, you're building yourself on, like, we know what to do with pitchers. And yes, you've had some success stories with Tolley and Early and so forth. But man, yeah. Baio has just been a mess. The whole thing is just
make
so
a great
bad.
Point.
Oh boy.
They've been playing at this park since 5 days after the Titanic sank. Okay? It was 8 years before women could vote. Like, it has been a long time. It's been a lot of baseball games in Fenway Park. And no Red Sox team has ever been this bad at playing there.
Again, small sample. Okay, they got a lot of home games left. The modern record, like, since we had 162-game schedule, worst record ever by a Red Sox team since they started playing 81 home games, 34-47, which has happened three times, 1965, 2012, 2014.
Oh, they'll beat it.
Like, that's the thing. Do I think that they're going to get 24 more home wins? No. it's been brutal. So, really, really bad. That's my bad.
Also, another little bad friend of the program. Did you see the story of a Caleb Durbin going to, like, drive to a hitting facility somewhere else in Boston? Which, like, yeah. I understand guys do that sometimes. But wasn't the whole point of this Red Sox team, like, coaching staff turnover that they, like, are offering the hitters the right? Like, maybe it's not connected, but it does not a good optical.
As often with the Red Sox. The optics, not great.
Bad optics. Also, the interview that Brian Baio did, terrible optics. Again, we don't speak Spanish. I don't like hating on translators, interpreters. If you're waiting 40 seconds for the player to, like, the player speaks for 40 seconds and then you're the interpreter and then you're saying what they just said, unless you're, like, you know, the guy from Suits or Psych, where you could just remember stuff, you're not remembering. If Jordan said 40 seconds worth of things in English, and then I had to say what he just said in English, I would not remember. In fact, Jordan, you don't know this, but that is actually kind of what the ADHD test is. Right. Like, when you get tested for ADHD, they tell you a story, and then they tell you another story, and then they're like, what was the first story? And you're like, I don't know.
That sounds fun. I should go for an ADHD test. There's so much more with the Red Sox, but we're running late. Oh. So you go to the bed.
Carmen Majinski saga, which seems to be over. Seems to be all patched up for now over in Pittsburgh. But this got weird and messy and very bad. Backstory. Carmen Majinski, tough name to spell. Tough to pronounce. Jordan has to correct me on it all the time, but it is Carmen Mudzinski. Was in the Pirates rotation to start the year and was really good. In fact, he was better than Bubba Chandler, the hyped young rookie hurler for the Pirates. When Jared Jones got off the IL, though, the game of musical chairs got dicey, and someone needed to move to the bullpen. And the Pirates said, Carmen Mudzinski, you move to the bullpen. And Carmen Mudzinski said, wah. He, it's more complicated than that, but what I heard was, wah, he kind of dragged his feet and said he didn't want to pitch in the bullpen. And there was an uncomfortable interview where he like kind of wavered and said, we'll see. He was like, I have to talk to my people. Like, which felt like I'll have my mom talk to your mom to set up a play date. Like having to talk to the answer should be, I'll do whatever the team needs. Now, from Carmen Mudzinski's perspective, you understand why he's frustrated. He pitched better than Bubba Chandler. Moving to the bullpen's bad for the pocket. The Pirates have seemed to now split the difference where he's going to like work in bulk out of the bullpen and stay stretched out so that eventually when another Pirates starter gets hurt, he will just move back into the rotation. There was also a situation where the Pirates didn't have Mudzinski speak, and then they had him talk to Jason Mackey, who's their own personal – he's not even like their – is he like the beat writer for MLB.com?
It's hard like to describe, in between. Jason, but it's more of a voice.
He's not
of
the league. Beat, but he's more like
voice of the
team's voice of the team. And so he just like gave an interview Mudzinski did with Jason Mackey that went up on Pirates.com that was very journalistically hazy, where he was not then offered up to independent reporters within a smaller amount of time. And the whole thing just got really ugly and bad and was unfortunate because for all of the things that the Pirates have done to not look like LOL Pirates, this whole thing has felt like LOL Pirates, even though it's not necessarily like their fault, right? I think moving Mudzinski to the bullpen is the correct decision because Chandler has a higher ceiling to stay in the rotation and you need to put Jared Jones back in there. But something went haywire here along the way. And at the end of the day, even if Mudzinski is the one making a less than optimal decision, it makes the Pirates look bad.
I agree with that. And then the real topper here is that then in a situation where it was like, clearly you should use Carmen Mudzinski in relief here after Paul Skeens the other night, they didn't for some reason. And their bullpen completely melted down and they lost that game. He did pitch last night and was pretty good. After Jared Jones, but that whole thing was messy. So Pirates are a weird team. I don't know what to make of them, but maybe you will find out soon if you go see them. All right, let's do Ugla before we say goodbye. My Ugla this week is a baseball game that took place between the Dominican Summer League Rangers Blue team and the Dominican Summer League Angels team.
One of the most heated rivalries in all sports, I believe.
Yeah. Dominican Summer League season just began. You had a fantastic story recently talking about a ridiculous game that happened in the Arizona Complex League between the Dodgers and Giants, where the Giants won by a million runs and what that says about the current state of minor league baseball and pitching and whatever. Great story. I don't mean to downplay it. However, thanks. I don't want to say that this box score is really reflective of anything other than that sometimes weird stuff happens in the DSL. And in this case, this 19-18 victory by the DSL Angels is one of the funniest box scores, particularly one of the funniest line scores that I have ever seen. This game featured the Angels going up 7-0 through four innings, blowing the lead. This game was 9-9 going to the top of the ninth. The Rangers put up 9 runs. Okay, let's go. We're
game over.
Let's get 3 outs. It's 18-9. This game's over. It's not over. It's not over. Not only did the Angels come back and score 10 runs in the bottom of the ninth, they did it all with 2 outs. It's the funniest part. And it goes walk, fly out, fly out. All right, hey, it's hot. It's like it's 2 p.m. and in the Boca Chica or wherever they were playing nearby, and it's like, all right, let's go get. Nope. Uh oh. Error. Error on the shortstop with 2 outs. And then from there, just absolute disaster. Floodgates open. We got multiple pitching changes, wild pitches, bunts. We got more walks, hit by pitches, no homers, of course. Angels walk it off. Just amazing. This is one of the funniest box scores I've ever seen. So pretty ugly.
9 in the top, 10 in the bottom. Thanks for coming out to the ball yard. And the best part is, like, 9 people saw it.
If that. They do not list attendance here, but it does say that the game lasted 4 hours and 40 minutes.
Which is
brutal. With pitch clock. With pitch clock.
And the heat.
9 innings. Oh, my God. 14 errors, by the way, between the two teams. Sorry.
Let's figure it out.
Yeah.
That team's not getting out of a regional. My ugla, I thought about maybe wanting to turn this into a segment, Jordan, because we just are talking so much about the frickin' Pope. We could call it like Rome runs or, you know, holy hit. I think we can workshop
a lot of options
at Vatican, at Vatican, you know, let us know. What should the Pope, maybe just call Pope Knows Ball. You just keep it that simple. My ugly this week is Pope related, as it usually is. The mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson, went to Rome to kick it with his South Sidiness and brought the Pope a Cubs hat because Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago, is a Cubs fan. The Pope, the mayor of the Catholics, is a White Sox fan. And so the mayor the mayor was trying to do this cutesy, like, I got you a Cubs hat, Pope. And there is an amazing photo of the Pope almost like he's the mayor is holding the hat like, I got you a hat. And the Pope is like grabbing and like scrunching up the hat. Like you would with like a sandwich wrapper when you're done to like when you're about to throw it in the garbage, because
that's what he's going to do. That's what
he does not want this hat. He does not want this hat. This Pope does not want this hat from this mayor. You know, the mayor is giggling and you can see that the Pope is like a little steamed. He's a little biffed, a little miffed, excuse me, about this. What do you think happened to this Cubs hat? Do you think this is being kept in the papal archives, or
the
mayor kept it?
He's not throwing it out, but he's shoving it in a drawer somewhere and saying, get this out of my sight. This is disgusting. It's not just that the Pope is a White Sox fan. It's that when the Pope was announced, the Cubs tried to claim him and the family had to come out and be like, no. Not so fast.
Not only did the Cubs try to claim the Pope, they put a message on the outside of Wrigley where it says like Cubs, like the famous marquee. The marquee, that means it's like that's marquee sports, right? It's the marquee. It said it was like, hey, Chicago, he's a Cubs fan, right? And then the family was like, no, he's not. And so I don't think I like the mayor bringing him a Cubs hat. I think this isn't a joke to the Pope, Mayor.
That's the thing.
This isn't a joke. This guy was at the World Series in 2005. Okay. We know it's on TV. I would have not done that. I would have just brought him like a Jordan and MJ jersey because, you want a little cute moment with the Pope.
Right.
I hope, actually, no, that's a very uncool thing to say. But I hope another 108 years. The curse of the Pope. The curse of
I have no ill will towards Cubs fans. I will say though, like, this is a rare instance where like Cubs fans should never at any point feel like they need to be, you know, pick me. I mean, you're the Cubs. Like,
you've been picked.
You're doing good. You're fine. That's what's kind of disappointing here is almost the desperation to try and pull a guy who it's like, no, there are White Sox fans. Let them be White Sox fans. That's okay. You got plenty of Cubs fans.
Like, you've
so
Bill Murray.
I'd love to hear from some Chicago folks about this.
Bill Murray.
Let us know. Cubs, okay, Chicago people on either side here, how do you feel about our reaction to this? Let us know. But guess what? It'll probably be another ugly again in the future.
When the Pope finally goes to Chicago, I don't think we're going to get the Pope in America for a bit. But like, when the Pope does show up in the States, he should bring the mayor a White Sox hat and be like,
Yeah. Mm-mm-mm. Hey, nice try. Thank you all for listening to this Friday edition of Baseball Barbercast. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for joining me from Sweden. You will be back stateside on Monday, I believe. I hope. Safe.
I will.
Convenient travels.
Thank you for covering for me for this week. It was nice to take some time away. My best friend from college lives here in Stockholm, and it has been very enjoyable to visit with him. My former roommate in New York City is now not a lot of baseball here in Stockholm, Jordan. However, a lot of Yankees hats around here, so I will check in to see if folks think that Jason Dominguez will take advantage of this opportunity presented by the Aaron Judge interview.
Please do.
Excuse me.
please do. You can email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing as always. We will talk to you all on Monday.